Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Our guest today is Dr. Quinn Monson, an associate professor of political science at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. Professor Monson specializes in American politics with an emphasis on voting behavior. He earned his PhD at the Ohio State University a little more than a decade ago. Quinn appeared on our show in the past, alongside David Campbell, talking about their book, Seeking the Promised Land, Mormons and American Politics, which was also co-authored with John Green. In addition to this book, Quinn has written numerous articles and book chapters on topics as varied as gender and candidate success, the effectiveness of mass mailings and campaigns, the job satisfaction of poll workers, and civic education. These works have appeared in journals such as Political Behavior, the American Journal of Political Science, and Public Opinion Quarterly, to name just a few. He has a long-term interest in the role of religion in the electoral landscape and recently published an article in the Cambridge Journal, Politics and Religion, entitled Who's In and Who's Out? The Politics of Religious Norms, which was co-authored with his BYU colleagues Christopher Karpowitz and Kelly Patterson. We will be talking about that article today. Professor Monson is no stranger to quality research, and this has been widely recognized, as he has netted several Best Paper Awards from the American Political Science Association's various sections, including Religion and Politics and the Political Science Education Group. We will link to his bio at BYU and on our website. And it is the holiday season, so give the gift of learning by telling your friends about Research on Religion. Best of all, it's free gratis to everybody who tunes in. Quinn, welcome back to Research on Religion.
I'm glad to be back.
One of the things that I always hear when I tell folks that I'm a political science professor is, wow, you must be really busy with all that's going on. This is usually in reference to some recent national election or something that the U.S. president says. And I have to disappoint these folks often by telling them that I do absolutely nothing that is of interest to any common person. But you, Quinn, you're an electoral politics specialist, so you must be the talk of the party at every social gathering that you go to. So my question for you is, wow, you must be really busy with all that's going on.
I do get busy around election time, and I actually do some consulting as well as political science. So I especially get busy because I have clients that want data.
Wow, political consulting. So candidates call you up and they say, run some surveys for us and crunch the numbers and things?
Yeah, we do some surveys and data analytics for a handful of political clients. And, you know, political candidates are among the most demanding because it's their jobs are on the line. There's urgency to it with the election approaching. They're really an interesting crowd.
Yeah, no, it's always an all or nothing type of thing. I've done marketing research for restaurants and things like that in the past, but nothing as high pressured as that kind of stuff. And speaking of this, all this data crunching and that, I want to ask a question about our field. We're both political scientists, and it seems that we were really, really caught by surprise by the election of Donald Trump. And I don't know if we've been really doing a good job recently in thinking through campaigns or predicting what is going to happen. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, first, I should say I was caught by surprise along with everyone else. And I think it's because we're better at explaining the past than we are predicting the future. It's simply true that if we applied the existing models that we had for elections, none of us would have predicted Donald Trump. But it was you know, there were new things on the horizon that we didn't know about very much, or we hadn't been paying as much attention to, and so it's a chance for us to recalibrate and adjust. I think actually, there's some good work that's coming out now that's explaining 2016, that's helping us understand it better. And I think there's some older work that's getting new attention. So I'm thinking particularly of the work of Catherine Kramer that I think was well-regarded all along, but got a lot of attention in the wake of the 2016 election results to look at her work on the politics of resentment, for example. I think that warrants another look by people that are really interested in understanding the election.
Yeah, I guess one of the good things about being wrong about making predictions is that it creates a whole new cottage industry of papers that look at why we were wrong to begin with. So we're never out of a job, I guess. So, yeah, a lot of interesting things here. We're not here to discuss the Trump administration, though. Even though that's on everybody's mind, we want to talk instead about how religion affects campaigns and voting behavior. And an interesting article that you recently wrote entitled Who's In and Who's Out, The Politics of Religious Norms, is on the table here. So what was the general motivating question behind this project of religious norms and being in and out?
Well, I think for our group of co-authors, as we, you know, gather in the hallway and at lunch and so on, talking about what was going on in the 2012 election and the nomination of the first Mormon for president, we had a lot of talk amongst ourselves about how people were talking about his religion, and we broadened that to a question about, you know, are there really boundaries surrounding how we talk about religion with each other? So we use this particular election context to ask that broader question. When you're at a party and you're talking with a group of friends, and the subject of somebody's religion comes up, or religion in general, is it okay or not okay to say disparaging things about that religion?
Yeah, that's going to be a very interesting question, because I think we're going through general cultural phase right now where we're changing what these boundaries are, what is acceptable and what is not. So you're, I think, on the cutting edge of something, and it's really fascinating to be looking at here. You work with two co-authors, Christopher Karpowitz and Kelly Patterson. How is that working with two people? Actually, I looked at a lot of your work. You co-author a lot. I'm kind of a lone wolf. How is it working with others?
I almost exclusively co-author, and I really enjoy it, and I think when you find co-authors that you work together well with and who have complementary talents, it's a win-win. And in this case, I've got two co-authors that are in the same hallway as me. They, you know, one next door and one two doors down, and we see each other all the time, and we end up hatching ideas to work on projects just because we're friends and we hang out and talk a lot. And but I think that's the fun part of research is working with others.
Yeah, I want to emphasize that for any young scholars who are listening to the program, graduate students or even undergraduates, you know, don't underestimate the hallway banter, meeting over lunch and talking about things, because that's the opportunity to throw out lots and lots of crazy ideas. And most of the ideas that we throw out are crazy, and then we throw them out. But every so often, there's these diamonds in the rough that if you polish a little bit longer, they become really, really good, interesting research papers with some cool findings. Let's go ahead and start talking about your paper now, and it is about religious norms, but the paper also talks a lot about norms in general, and I want to focus on that since I'm an economist, or a political economist, and I don't do norms that much. So tell us what these things are. What are norms? How do they operate? And what impact do they have in campaigns, voting behavior, and politics in general?
Okay. Well, let's just define norms for a minute, and I think we'll start with a more formal definition and then move to a sort of a more colloquial definition. The more formal definition is to think about it as the collective consciousness of a community. It's the shared values and beliefs that we have, things about which we have some consensus. And so what does that mean? Well, it's something that we widely agree upon in terms of behavior, both for things that we should do or that we should not do. And norms are widely agreed upon, but they're not prescribed by law. In other words, when we really widely share a belief about something, then we it goes beyond being a norm, and we tell people that they're forbidden to do it. So you know, we have norms against stealing, but we also prohibit it by law, right? So in this case, a norm is something that's widely agreed upon, that's not prescribed by law, but has some means of enforcement. So just to give a simple example, think about our collective behavior when it comes to waiting in line. Mm-hmm. When we go to the grocery store, or when we go to a ticket window and there's a large crowd, right? Typically, a line forms and we patiently wait our turn. Although I would add that there are differences culturally between, you know, Eastern and Western culture about whether a line forms at all. But in Western culture, we form a line, and the norm is you wait your turn, okay? And when somebody violates that norm, then what happens? So when somebody tries to cut in front, sometimes they could be ignored if the stakes are low, but if it's a really scarce environment and the lines are long, you could see somebody getting confronted, right? Or somewhere in between, you could get looks of shame or derision, right? So there's different. When I say enforcement, the enforcement could be, the sanctions could be for violating the norm, could be a dirty look from somebody that you cut in front of, or it could be that they actually say something to you like, "Hey, wait your turn." Or, you know, they could try to call the manager or something to get you moved back in the line where you belong.
Yeah, I use this example quite a bit in our political economy classes. And even though I say I don't study norms, I'm actually studying norms increasingly now, because they are rules that regulate our behavior. And the interesting thing you say about lines is that, let's say you're waiting to get into a movie and somebody cuts in line in front of you, you know that's only going to cost you like about a minute and a half of time. It's not that big a deal. But when I ask students and other people to think about it, it's like violation of that first come, first serve norm just like rips at your soul. You just get so angry at this. And if the stakes are high, right, if this is to get into The Last Jedi and you don't know if the last few seats are going to be sold out, I mean, that's when people are like, "Hey, buddy, get out of line. I can't," exactly. Blah, 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 right?
And, you know, this happens with tipping, which you study a lot. This happens in all sorts of ways, and there are community norms. You could even think of something like political ideology as a norm, there are shared beliefs, and so when you might behave differently. Think of how we behave and talk when we are surrounded by people that agree with us politically, versus when we're in a crowd that's mixed, right? And you might choose to censor what you say when you know that somebody from the opposing viewpoint is nearby, versus when you're among a group that you are confident shares your beliefs.
I'm glad that you mentioned the tipping thing, because we will now link to my talk on tipping for folks that are interested in it, and that's one of my favorite norms to discuss. But I want to actually talk about not religious norms again, we're still getting there, but you wrote another paper recently on the private act of voting. I think the title of the article is Political Norms and the Private Act of Voting. So put these norms into play for politics, Russ, and then we'll talk about religion and politics next.
Well, there are community norms that we feel pressure to follow. So there's a whole line of research, for example, in political science these days about social pressure and voter turnout, and how you can influence somebody's likelihood of voting by reminding them that we have this duty to vote, or this norm to vote, and especially reminding them that somebody might be watching or might notice if they don't vote and might report it to their neighbors. And so there's a sense of shame that comes from maybe your neighbors finding out that you didn't do your civic duty and vote, right? The same also exists, and this is what we found in our article, in terms of a local community. There are norms about who everyone might be supporting. So in the article that we wrote on the political norms, it actually does have to do with religion a little bit, because the focus of the article is a presidential primary in Utah in 2008, when Mitt Romney was on the ballot. And of course, Mitt Romney did extremely well in the Republican presidential primary. But of course, there was a Democratic primary going on at the same time. And there were people that were showing up to either vote a Democratic ballot or that were showing up to vote for somebody other than Mitt Romney. But they were definitely in the political minority and not conforming with the social norm of the community. And so our question was, do these folks feel differently when they vote? And is there a sense of a heightened need for privacy as they vote? And so we did a field experiment where we got a local local county election office to allow us to randomly assign voters to which room they would vote in. And we set up one room that had enhanced, what we called enhanced privacy features, which essentially amounted to some black and yellow tape on the floor and some signs that said, please respect the privacy of those who are voting. And we noticed that it did have effects. It heightened the salience of the importance of privacy to the voters who were randomly assigned to that room. And it also affected the behavior of the poll workers who treated that tape on the floor as if it were some kind of barrier that they wouldn't walk across. When we put it down and put up these signs, suddenly when voters had questions and they were at the machine, they wouldn't cross that line and approach the machine without being invited by the voter. And so it did actually create this sense of additional privacy for the voters and help them to navigate this majoritarian sort of political norm where the local, you know, Mormon community was very heavily in favor of the favorite son, Mitt Romney.
That's a really neat study because it reminds me of the pharmacies at the grocery stores now that put up these little signs saying, please respect the privacy of the person who's ordering pills. And they put it, you know, 2 feet behind them. It's not like you're going to be unable to hear what they're saying, but it's just all of a sudden it reminds you that, yeah, privacy is very valuable. So kind of put your head down, ignore what they're doing, and I ignore what they're doing, they'll ignore what I'm doing. We all have our private sphere.
And that actually was something we learned on the fly in that field experiment. The big regret that I think our team had is that we learned throughout the day that perhaps the biggest concern wasn't actually when voters cast their ballot for privacy. It was actually when they had to step up to the table and check in and request a Republican ballot or a Democratic ballot. So if you're in a very one-sided partisan community and you go to vote in a primary and you basically have to state your partisanship for everyone in the line to hear is you request a ballot. That's the point that I think makes a lot of voters uncomfortable, and they would rather, I think if we'd put a piece of tape and had the line step back 10 feet from the table, that would have even enhanced the sense of privacy further.
Very cool. Well, there's a opportunity for another paper.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let's go ahead and talk about norms and how these things develop and how they're regulated. And we've already touched upon this a little bit, but your paper in Politics and Religion goes into this a little bit deeper about how people decide to sanction or not to sanction, and then how this is related to public discourse. So fill us in on some of those details.
Well, I think the sanctioning behavior comes down to the idea of how widely shared the norms are. So in terms of a norm against disparaging speech about a religious group, you know, we're getting back to the question of whether or not people have these widely shared norms, and then the decision about whether to sanction or not becomes one of how internalized is that norm, how widely shared, and we use the term that we draw from the literature, metanorm. Something that's a metanorm is something that is so widely shared that it's universal. It's internalized enough across a broad group of people that it's almost universal. And then I guess the other part of it is if it's a really serious violation, or if it's felt to be a serious violation, then the likelihood of being willing to sanction goes up, and again, sanction can be anything from a dirty look to a comment to push back a little bit to trying to get somebody fired for their behavior, right?
You also talk about a You talk about a consequentialist framework in terms of norms, and that people always explain to me consequentialism, and I always forget what it means. So give me a shot at this. How do norms work within a consequentialist framework?
Again, I think the consequentialist framework simply has to do with the idea that whether or not a violation of the norm will lead to a sanction. So the more widely shared the norm, the more internalized the norm, the more likely it is that it will have consequences. It will lead to a sanction from those around when the norm is violated.
Okay. Now, here's the next question for you, because you're a quantitative political scientist. You're from the Ohio State University, where they do a lot of this stuff. And measurement becomes a big issue.
Yeah.
We talk about, well, norms are widely shared. Well, yeah, but how do we know that? How can we measure whether a norm is deeply held, widely held, and what?
Well, I think it's tricky. It's tricky to do that, and I think one way you can do that is simply ask people in a public opinion survey to report whether something is widely shared. But of course, the problem with that is that self-reported attitudes and behaviors don't always reflect what we hold deep inside our heads. And there's some social desirability problems with people knowing the correct answer. You can have trouble getting at norms. So you might be able to measure that something is a norm, but you're not going to measure the extent to which that norm is likely violated. And so there's a long string of literature in both political science and psychology and sociology that talks about something like racism, for example, where clearly our norms over racial bigotry have changed over time. Where, you know, if you were in the United States in the 1940s or 30s, and you said something disparaging about an African American, that might be perfectly acceptable. And in fact, there are words that we no longer use, right? That maybe were more common. Even things I heard as a kid. I haven't heard for years. I haven't heard anyone say. I think there's evidence that those norms have been internalized and have changed, but it's difficult to measure that, and it's difficult especially to measure the remaining bias that exists in among, you know, the public. Nobody wants to admit that they have racially insensitive views, or that they are bigoted in some way when you ask them straightforwardly on a survey. You know, if you ask the question, are you a racial bigot, yes or no? Most people have the good sense to say no.
And it's interesting, too, because it's not even in these high-stake things like racism, but we were talking about the lining up principle, or what I call the first-come, first-serve principle. And I asked students in class, too, I go, what's the norm for picking a seat in a classroom? And students don't know. They go, I don't know. There is no rule. What do you mean? But there is. It's this unconscious, you know, first person in the room gets the pick of the seats, and they kind of get that seat for the rest of the semester. And when you make this apparent to students, they're like, oh, yeah. You know, so norms really kind of operate in the background without us being consciously aware of them. So tough to measure.
Right. So I guess that's why we chose an experimental setting. A way to measure it that wasn't exactly a direct measure. You sort of give somebody a little a vignette and ask them to react to it, and you're not asking them, you know, is this bad? Do you think that disparaging this religion is bad? Instead, you randomly assign which religion is being disparaged to different groups and measure the reaction, and the difference between those reactions becomes your measure for whether or not norms exist.
Okay, let's hold off on that experiment a minute, because I want to go through the nitty-gritty nuts and bolts details of those things, but we need to set it up with the question which you're trying to explore here, which is religious pluralism and toleration, or lack thereof. Give us a sense of this general landscape of religious intoleration. You go through a little bit of the history of this in the United States. What groups are in, what groups are out? How has this changed over time? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, sure. We have a long tradition in our constitutional framework of religious freedom and toleration, but it's not always played out very well in practice. And so, of course, there's a long history in American politics of anti-Catholicism and anti-Semitism and anti-Mormonism, where minority religious groups, non-Christian groups in particular, have faced difficulty. And we see things evolve where anti-Semitism and anti-Catholicism, for example, I think were widespread early in the 20th century and diminished with time, especially anti-Semitism post-World War II with the horrors of the Holocaust and others, things that come out. It becomes apparent that that's, you know, something that's no longer socially acceptable, even though, right, that's not the same thing as claiming that anti-Catholicism or anti-Semitism no longer exists. They certainly still exist, but it's not socially acceptable to hold those opinions in the same way that it once was.
What about the tension between seculars and religious? That seems to be a new and growing tension here that a number of other scholars have pointed out, including one of your former co-authors, John Green, that it's not just Protestants don't like Catholics, but it might be a growing separation between secular people don't like religious people and vice versa. What can you say about that?
I think there's some of that, and I think that that's how this political controversy over religious freedom has evolved and been framed. So back in the 90s, you have a very famous Supreme Court decision, Employment Division versus Smith, that changed our perception of religious freedom, changed the interpretation of religious freedom from the Supreme Court. And you have the Congress of the United States pushing back with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And at the time that was passed, there was this broad coalition of religious groups and the ACLU and others that were in favor of sort of restoring the previous standard that the court had abandoned on religious freedom. And you had secularists and religious people united in defending the First Amendment rights of religious people. Well, that's since been politicized in the wake of I think gay marriage controversy and decisions in this recent case with the baker in Colorado, where it's now religious people that are most fiercely defending religious freedom and secularists that have objected to the way that religious people view gay marriage and related issues. And so it's really changed over time. And I think you're right. I think that is a place that probably demands additional research to see if religious people and secular, you know, believers and non-believers can get along and learn to reciprocate instead of up the ante in sort of in terms of denying each other rights, basically.
So let's see how this plays out in the world of political campaigns, deciding what you can say in public discourse, who's in the group, who's out of the group, with specific reference to religion. And you're primarily focused here on the 2012 election, Mitt Romney, the first Mormon running for president, and that becomes an issue. So you go out and do an experiment, a field experiment, that was part of the 2012 Cooperative Congressional Election Study. Brief us what that study was, what a field experiment is, what you wanted to test, and how you went about doing it.
So the Cooperative Congressional Election Study is a collaboration between several dozen universities across the country. So there's a principal investigator that organizes all of this, and essentially it means that these teams of researchers pool their resources and collectively do an election survey, a pre- and post-election survey that involves many thousands of interviews. And it's really nice because you can get data back, I think the 2016 one, for example, has a total of 56,000 cases. And so each team gets approximately 1,000 cases for their own module of their of the survey, and that's tacked on to a common content, they call it, that is asked of all of the survey respondents. So there's 56,000 respondents that answer the question about who they voted for and some basic demographics and other attitudinal questions that are of broad interest. And that is, you know, several minutes at the front end of the survey, and then they get randomly assigned into these modules that different teams put together. And so there was a team from BYU that that put together a module, and our questions for this project made up just a small part of that module, in fact. So it's actually a great resource because it enables a researcher to get nationally representative data at a very affordable price. So when you pool across several universities and then even within a university for one team across several individuals, suddenly you have a nationally representative experiment sample that only costs you, you know, $2,000 or $3,000, which is, you know, a fraction of what you would pay if you had to commission this thing and field it on your own. So that's a real benefit.
I have an interesting question here. It just popped into my mind. Here in the state of Washington, we have mail-in ballots. We don't go to the election polling booth anymore. Does that factor in? I mean, is this a situation where you're doing these questionnaires, you know, at the polling booth? Are you doing it at home? And then the other thing with mail-in ballots, we can start voting, a month ahead of time. So if you're not doing this survey 2 months ahead of time, you're missing a group of people that you would get the pre-survey for before you can administer the post one. So it becomes complicated.
Yeah, it does. I think the key here is that the post survey comes after the results are announced.
Okay.
But you're right. This is all administered online, and so the it's done by a company called YouGov out of Palo Alto or near Palo Alto, and they have a very creative and I think pretty rigorous methodology that's not a traditional random sample, but it does involve a probability sample from an external data source, usually the American Community Survey from the U.S. Census. And then they take their panel participants who have volunteered, they have millions of them, of people that have volunteered to be part of these online panels, and they do a very complicated algorithm where they find the closest matched across a whole slew of factors. So they find the panel participant that matches the randomly selected individual from the American Community Survey, and they use that matched person in lieu of having a true random sample. And it's proven to be quite good in the sense that you get a pretty accurate and nationally representative sample, and you do so at a scale where you can get 56,000 interviews and still afford to pay for it all.
So tell us about what you were doing specifically with your experiment, and give us a sense for what questions you were asking. And the other question I have to ask, because it was an experiment, did you guys wear lab coats when you were doing this research?
I wish I had a lab coat. I should get one and put it on the back of my office door just for show.
I have to tell you that when I taught methodology classes way back when, I did order a lab coat online from a medical supply company, and now I can always get these magazines about, you know, medical research and stuff because they think I'm a lab coat type of researcher, not a political scientist. So you should do that. It's fun. Anyways, all right, tell us about your experiment here. Give us the questions.
So in this case, we're doing a survey experiment. So in a field experiment, you would be doing something on people as they went about their daily life. And in this case, it's a little more contrived in a survey experiment where they're coming on their computer to answer a bunch of political questions, and we're delivering an experiment in the middle of them taking a survey, which simply means that we devised a question in which different respondents were randomly assigned to get different versions of a question. And the key to any experiment is that randomization, where by random assignment, you distribute all of the characteristics that might affect how people answer between the groups, and those groups should be have equal numbers of all of those different characteristics, and thereby anything that you get in terms of differences between the groups can be attributed to the treatment or the difference in the question and not to some characteristic that those respondents have. And so in this case, we were inspired to come up with this treatment. We were trying to think of, well, how can we measure religious norms? And our inspiration came from a segment that in the midst of 2012 got a little bit of attention. It was a segment of Bill Maher where he, with some panelists on his late night show, really went after Mormons. Now, Bill Maher doesn't like Mormons, but in fairness, Bill Maher doesn't like any religion.
Yeah.
So, but in this case, he went after Mormons. And, you know, we're at BYU, and Mitt Romney's the Mormon nominee for the Republicans, and so, you know, we noticed, and we thought, I wonder if we could make this into a treatment. And so we basically took what Bill Maher said, and then the other thing we'd noticed is when we were reading stories about Mitt Romney and his religion, and there were a lot of stories about Mormons in the news in 2011 and 2012. I mean, just dozens of them. And of course, because I'm a scholar that does religion and I do Mormons, I got a lot of calls from reporters. I mean, I did dozens and dozens of interviews in that election cycle. And so I would end up going and reading some of the stories I was quoted in and other stories, paying a lot of attention to this. And one thing you quickly notice if you read stories about Mormons is that the comment sections quickly turn into a cesspool of disparaging remarks. It's really disheartening, in fact, to read, and so you learn to not read the comments. But in this case, we actively searched out the comments of a few articles and looked for, you know, patterns of the kinds of things that people said, and used some of those comments to juice up the Bill Maher segment just a little bit. So the question that we came up with, a little vignette we came up with, reads as follows. It says, while discussing religion and politics on a national television news program, a political commentator recently made the following statement. People don't know much about, and then there's a blank where we fill in the name of the religious group. People don't know much about Mormons, for example. When they find out, they are amazed at how weird they really are. They're just not normal. What a strange group. They're disgusting, really. So that was the quote, right? So this not Bill Maher, he wasn't named, but this anonymous political commentator called whatever group not normal, strange, and disgusting. And so it was the groups that we chose were Mormons, Catholics, Jews, Muslims, evangelicals, and then we threw in Mitt Romney just to have a political figure, and also to kind of satisfy our own curiosity about how reactions from the Republican nominee would differ from these various religious groups. And then we asked people after a set of questions about agree or disagree about whether people should be reprimanded for making statements like this. I feel uncomfortable when I read comments like this. No one should be ridiculed like this. Comments like this should be allowed, even if they make some people uncomfortable. And there is some truth to the political commentator's statement. So some opportunities to answer agree and disagree both. And that gives you a sense for whether or not the respondent who got us randomly assigned this particular religious group felt that there was something bad going on. There was something wrong with the commentator going after this particular religious group or not.
And this is how you're getting at the sanctioning behavior, because you're not standing in a polling line and trying to measure whether people are giving, you know, sideways glances and disparaging scowls or something.
Yeah, so there's that measure of their agreement and disagreement with those statements. And then we also get at sanctioning more directly by just asking people in an open-ended question after to respond. So the open-ended question that came actually before the statements was, we ask them to imagine that the news program has a web page that allows for anonymous comments. If you were to post a comment about the statements above, what would you say? So we're basically asking them to post a comment, and then we content coded those comments to see if there was any sort of hint of sanctioning in the comments as well, that the open-ended comments. And then we ask them to agree or disagree with all the items. And so we get very consistent results between those two things, actually, which is nice.
In reading those open-ended comments, were there any things that really stuck out? I mean, usually when you get these open-ended comments, people write, I don't know, 4 or 5 words or something like, oh, I don't know, or yeah, I guess so. But was there any thing that just really popped out saying, I would wish I could find this person and slap him on the wrist or something?
Yeah, there were some things like that. This guy should be fired, you know, and even some surprising expressions of animosity toward the religious group, like, you know, a little bit of he's right, they are weird kind of stuff as well. Not as much of that, but some of that as well. So kind of across the spectrum, actually.
One of the other questions that comes up in this running of this experiment, it's online, this goes back to your privacy thing before, you're trying to tell people that this is anonymous. How much do you think that the online environment in which they're taking these surveys affects them? Because again, the comment sections on those articles, you're anonymous, nobody can tell if you're a dog on the internet, so to speak, and so you just let fly. But if you were in a polling booth or if you were in a party, it might be different. What thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think we really get people's private behavior here in this survey environment, and so it certainly could be different if the mode of the survey were over the phone with a interviewer on the other end. Mm-hmm. So there's pretty good evidence that we get more honest answers out of people when they're answering a survey online and they're assured of anonymity and they have that sense of anonymity.
Okay. So you did all this stuff, and what did you find?
Well, we found that there's a real difference across these groups. So, for example, the clearest thing we found, well, two clear things that we found. There's clearly a norm that exists against anti-Semitism, and that is that norm holds across partisan groups in a way that I don't think was terribly surprising to us, but it was sort of a nice validation and confirmation to see that our measure is probably working because we got something that we expected to see. In other words, it wasn't okay when the randomly assigned group was the commentator making disparaging remarks about Jews. That really didn't go over well. So clearly, much higher levels of unease with the offensive statement and unease with the commentator both when the randomly assigned group was Jews. And then conversely, when it was Muslims, we got a very clear partisan split where Republicans were pretty much okay with the disparaging remarks and with the commentator that made them, and Democrats were very much not okay with it. So there's this very clear partisan divide on Muslims that was very surprising to us back in 2012, not so surprising today. And in fact, it feels a little bit like a precursor to 2016, that we sort of knew something that Donald Trump made evident to all of us, I think.
Do you find any other results in here as well? Is there age differences, gender differences, those kind of things?
We didn't go looking for a lot of that. And part of it is that when you randomly assign people to what do we have, 6 different groups here, and then you try to break that down further, you can't break it down very much further before you don't have any cases left. So we broke it down by party because that's pretty interesting and provides some interesting results. But going much further I don't think it produced much. And when it's more than a, you know, male female kind of Republican Democrat split, you lose enough cases that it doesn't hold up to much analysis.
What about when you inserted Mitt Romney in there, was there, I mean, we'd expect obviously a Democrat versus Republican split. And then what about Mormonism as well? Was there the effect as big as you thought it would be? Was it smaller? Were you surprised? What?
Well, the Mitt Romney case, it's that's a very good comparison to do Mitt Romney and Mormonism together, because of course he is a Mormon. But the what we found with Mitt Romney is that it helped us to feel some comfort with the measures in terms of their face validity, because what we found was that Democrats found it perfectly fine to disparage Mitt Romney and Republicans didn't. And that's kind of what you would expect. He's the Republican nominee, and of course Democrats are going to think it's fine to call him weird and strange and go after him, and Republicans are going to be defensive of him. But when you put Mormonism in the question, it does produce a little bit of a split, but it wasn't as big as we imagined it might be, in the sense that it kind of looked like the split for evangelical and Catholic, very similar, sort of in between what we found for Mormon or for Muslims and Jews, basically. And that's a little surprising in the sense that Mitt Romney's religion got so much attention, and the possibility of some kind of negative effect on his electoral prospects was sort of out there as a possibility. Not so surprising in the sense that in the other work that I have on Mitt Romney in 2012, it's very clear that his Mormonism was a very small part of his defeat in the general election. That he was defeated not because he was a Mormon. That was only a negative thing to a very small number of people.
Let me now extend these results over into the more speculative realm. You look at these results, you can report the differences in the coefficients, et cetera, et cetera. But then it's starting to think about what this means for the broader political landscape. And give me some of your general thoughts on that. And specifically, I'm interested in cultural shifts. If we do see shifts in norms occurring, and whether or not, say, for instance, Mitt Romney being the first Mormon to run, we hash out all this stuff on the Bill Maher program, we hash it out in the news and in the comment sections online. Does that lead to changes in norms? The fact that, you know, Mitt Romney ran might have us express this kind of general angst about Mormonism, then we realize, oh, maybe this isn't okay, and then the norm starts to shift over time. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't know that. So one question, one way to think about that question is, can we actively get people to shift their norms or not, or does it just kind of happen organically as we, as the news hits and we collectively decide that something is wrong? And I think I don't think we can actively do it as easily as some people might assert. I think so, and I think really the most relevant thing right now is how we view Muslims. I think that's the most relevant thing to talk about, and I think what we found in this paper, again, is something that really came to the forefront in the 2016 campaign. And so the question now is the partisan split that exists on norms about how we talk about, think about, and treat Muslims, is that likely to change? And if it's going to change, how is it going to change? And, boy, that's a difficult one. So let me just give you an example. I, for the last two or three years, I teach a one-day class on religious freedom at a week-long, it's just a conference held at BYU called Education Week, and it's mostly non-college students, adult Mormons that come to campus, and they spend several days going to little mini classes and learning about different topics. A lot of it is religious, some of it is academic, and I got asked to do this session on religious freedom and trends in religious freedom. And as part of that class, I present this research, at least a little bit of it. And I do so, and I emphasize the anti-Muslim part, because I'm mostly talking to a pretty conservative, mostly Republican group that has very strong feelings about religious freedom, their church has been emphasizing religious freedom in a big way, but they see religious freedom through the lens of how conservative minority religions like their own are being treated, and how, you know, and how evangelicals are being treated, how religious people more broadly are being treated. They don't see it in terms of how Muslims are being treated. And what I try to do is to say, basically, look, you want to be treated fairly in the United States by the government, by others, and before you go asking for fairness and go looking for protection of your religious freedom by the secular left, right? You need to make sure that you're not holding and harboring views that violate those very norms, right? You need to examine your attitudes about Muslims. And if you're to expect treatment that's fair, you need to offer treatment that's fair in return. Mm-hmm. And it's a little jarring to some. I think I get a lot of heads nodding, and occasionally I get a little pushback. Mm-hmm. But I think that's the real question, right? For those that are dealing with that question of religious freedom, yeah. how can religious minorities like Mormons or a beleaguered religious group in some sense, like evangelicals, right, expect to be treated in one way in terms of baking a cake for a gay wedding when they're in turn not reciprocating with fair treatment for Muslims, on the other hand? And so that I think when presented in those terms, right, both people on the religious right and people on the secular left begin to re-examine their view. So if I was in front of a in front of a secular crowd, I would express it in the opposite way, right? I would want them to think about, you know, if you really want Muslims to be treated fairly, this non-Christian group that you want to defend, how can you go after the baker in the same way? Right, and I think that's maybe the pathway forward in terms of taking the rhetoric down a notch or two and figuring out, you know, can we interact in good faith with each other? Can we learn to sort through questions of religious conscience and questions of fair treatment in a way that allows people to have deeply held religious beliefs and function in a free society? And those are difficult questions.
They are. I think Matthew 7:12 mentioned this a couple thousand years ago, or the old golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, kind of thing, is an important one, a really important
sure
one there.
Yeah, and that's a great principle, and there's a secular parallel to that that I think is pretty evident. I mean, it's been labeled the golden rule, even though and has the religious context sort of taken away from it for a reason, because it's universal.
Absolutely. Let me finish off with this question. You've been doing a lot of this survey research and poking and prodding voters and campaign officials and pollsters and all those kind of things for a number of years now. Is there anything that you've changed your mind about over the last, 15, 20 years that you've been in this profession and in a serious way, that anything that surprises you?
Wow. Well, I guess I'm constantly surprised by the good things that can be done with good high quality research. So so for example, I have another piece of work that just came out, and I don't want to get into the details of it too deeply, but we endeavored to do a field experiment where we try to figure out if we could help more women get elected. And we sort of held our breath with that particular one, and our treatment worked. And we were able to see more women get elected in a particular context from a very simple change. And I guess what I've learned is that some of the simplest adjustments can produce effects that are unexpected and positive. In this case, simply encouraging more women to run in a particular context and encouraging the voters in that context to think about electing more women had a very positive and significant effect. And it was a very small thing that produced the effect. And so I think that's the same with coming back to this idea of religious toleration and how we treat minority religious groups. There can be some very small things, including sanctioning behavior, that can produce large effects. So again, circle back to the idea of norms and imagine yourself at a party and you're surrounded by a group of friends and acquaintances and somebody says something disparaging about a particular religious group. And now the decision is, do you sanction or not? And I would say, it turns out that I think speaking up can have a large effect. I think that our responsibility to speak up, and I think we've learned in the wake of what's been going on in terms of sexual harassment in this country and this Me Too movement, that the power of speaking up can be incredible, and it can be amplified in a way that is unexpected. A simple act like standing up for somebody has enormous consequences, potentially.
Human beings are always open to change, and even the simplest things can help us improve society always. Stuff that you always bring to the fore, and I really appreciate the work that you do. My guest today has been Quinn Monson. Quinn, thanks for being on Research on Religion again.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.